From New York and Durban, South Africa, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
Stop U.S. racism all over the world! Stop U.S. racism all over the world!
Reparations now!
Reparations now!
What majority of people of color in America have decided they want. Reparation, they consider slavery and colonialism as crime against humanity.
That's right.
But the government of the United States have abandoned their people once again.
The U.S. withdraws, sort of, from the U.N. World Conference Against Racism in protest of criticism over Israel's treatment of Palestinians. We go live to Durban, South Africa, with reactions from Jesse Jackson, Nobel Peace Prize winner Rigoberta Menchú, and human rights groups from around the world. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now in Exile. I'm Amy Goodman. Over the past several years, the United States has embarked on a program of secret research on biological weapons that some officials say tests the global treaty banning such weapons. This according to a piece in the New York Times today. The 1972 treaty forbids nations from developing or acquiring weapons that spread disease, but it allows work on vaccines and other protective measures. Government officials said the secret research mimicked the major steps a state or terrorist would take to create a biological arsenal. The projects, which have not been previously disclosed, were begun under President Clinton and have been embraced by the Bush administration, which intends to expand them. The New York Times goes on to say, earlier this year, administration officials said the Pentagon drew up plans to engineer genetically a potentially more potent variant of the bacterium that causes anthrax, a deadly disease ideal for German warfare. A Bush administration official said the National Security Council is expected to give the final go-ahead later this month. Administration officials said the need to keep such projects secret was a significant reason behind President Bush's recent rejection of a draft agreement to strengthen the Germ Weapons Treaty, which has been signed by 143 nations. The draft would require those countries to disclose where they're conducting defensive research involving gene splicing or germs likely to be used in weapons. The sites would then be subject to international inspections. Among the facilities likely to be open to inspection under the draft agreement would be the West Jefferson, Ohio Laboratory of Battelle Memorial Institute, a military contractor that has been selected to create the genetically altered anthrax. And this piece from Robert Fisk in the British newspaper The Independent. He writes, just as the BBC last month ordered its reporters to use the phrase targeted killings for Israel's assassination of Palestinians, CNN has instructed its journalists to stop referring to Gilo as a Jewish settlement. Instead, they must call the settlement built illegally on occupied Arab land outside Jerusalem a Jewish neighborhood. The instruction from CNN's headquarters in Atlanta is straightforward. Quote, we refer to Gilo as a Jewish neighborhood on the outskirts of Jerusalem built on land occupied by Israel in 1967, the order states. We don't refer to it as a settlement. In the past, CNN used terrorists only about Arabs. The Israeli settler who murdered 29 Palestinians in a Hebron mosque in 1994 was always called an extremist on CNN, and at one point described Arab protests at the illegal settlements built by Jews on Palestinian land as conflicting heritage claims. A CNN spokesperson in Atlanta said last night, quote, we have no response to make to you. We don't want to get into a discussion on this. In fact, we'd rather not say anything about this at all. This news from Bogota. A new Colombian government report has raised fresh doubts about Washington's drug-fighting strategy in Colombia, saying aerial fumigation of crops may be damaging the environment and is failing to curb drug production. The report from Colombia's Comptroller General's office urged the president of Colombia to suspend the spraying of drug crops until scientists can study the environmental effects of the herbicide. The report also said the eradication campaign has failed to curb the drug industry in Colombia, the world's main producer of cocaine cocaine and the main exporter of heroin to the United States. The report also urged the government to devise strategies other than forced eradication to curb drug production and said promised social aid for coca farmers struggling to switch to legal crops has been insufficient and slow to arrive, a point acknowledged by a high-level delegation of the Bush administration that visited Colombia last week. The Bush administration is outraging even the Girl Scouts by its conservative positions in the run-up to a major world summit on children to be held later this month. The conference, organized by the UN Children's Fund, is scheduled for September 19th, a follow-up to a landmark summit in 1990, which aimed at setting guidelines for governments, special interest groups, and UN agencies. Since then, issues of protection of children have moved to the forefront. Children used as soldiers, as prostitutes, and as victims of HIV and poverty. Some 75 presidents and prime ministers, mostly from Africa and Asia and Latin America, will attend the conference. In an unusual alliance at the conference, the United States finds itself siding on several issues with conservative Muslim nations, Sudan, Libya, Iran, Pakistan, and Egypt, to the dismay of the European Union. Since the start of the negotiations in February, the U.S. delegation has sought to delete references to the 1989 Convention of the Rights of the Child, the backbone of UNICEF's work for a decade. The treaty, signed by President Clinton in 1995, has been ratified by all countries except the U.S. and Somalia, which did not have a government. Conservatives in Congress argue the treaty encroaches on parental rights and object to provisions against capital punishment or life imprisonment without parole for children. The U.S. delegation also opposes special mention of abuse and rehabilitation of girls in war zones, saying this would discriminate against boys and apparently fearing counseling on birth control and reproductive rights. We go now live to South Africa, but first some music from Oludum, uniting the blending of races.
Minha cultura é riqueza sem fim, infinito poder cultural. Traço meu caminho desvendando mistérios do mundo atual. Passo a passo eu estou em ascensão, progredindo sempre, sempre eu vou. Unindo a miscigenação, igualdade existente é a voz do pelô.
Unindo a miscigenação, igualdade existente é a voz do pelô.
Sou afrolotum,
sou afrolotum.
E aí?
Sou afrolotum do pelô. Sou afrolotum, Maciel Pelourinho foi quem me criou.
Sou afrolotum,
sou afrolotum.
E aí?
Sou afrolotum do pelô.
Opa!
Sou afrolotum.
Eu sou Olodum, canto lindo e distinto de cor. A raiz que firma meus passos, Pelourinho, Maciel, Salvador. Vou vivendo com perseverança, na esperança de mundo melhor.
Welcome to Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. As we go live to Durban, South Africa, the U.S. today is insisting it's not withdrawing from the U.N. World Conference Against Racism. In a call to U.N. Human Rights Commissioner Mary Robinson from the airport, the head of the U.S. delegation said that the U.S. would keep a single official in Durban who would retain delegate status. The conversation came after the U.S. delegation sent a statement announcing its withdrawal to the U.S. non-governmental delegation last night. Israel quickly followed the move. Both countries withdrew in protest at language in conference drafts that branded Israel as racist for its treatment of Palestinians in the occupied territories. We're joined in Durban studios right now by Tom Goldtooth, who's executive director of the Indigenous Environmental Network, as well as Malika Dutt, who is executive director of Breakthrough, a U.S. and India-based organization, and a member of the U.S. NGO Coordinating Committee for the World Conference. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Tom Goldtooth, let's begin with you. You were meeting with the delegation just before it announced it had withdrawn last night. What were they saying?
Yeah, that's right. We had been in an effort to meet with them for about 2.5 days when we found out that they had sent a delegation here. And we finally established that meeting at 5:30. And at that meeting, they knew already, you know, some of the main issues that we wanted to talk to them about. But before we went into the discussion, they said they had something to tell us. And they said that that they had received some marching orders from Washington, D.C., that their delegation is being withdrawn, and that, you know, that really any other discussion around various issues was really a moot point at this point. So it really surprised us because we had not heard that they had, you know, decided that they were officially going to withdraw. And they felt, they also told us that, you know, they wouldn't be able to talk about that, that that was being that discussion was being reserved by a press conference within an hour.
And what were the reasons they gave you?
We asked them that question, and they just said no comment on that, that those questions would be addressed when the United States officials make their announcement in their press conference. And to our understanding, that was supposed to be done back in Washington, D.C.
Malika Dutt, did you get more information as a member of the U.S. NGO Coordinating Committee for the World Conference?
Amy, last evening we had organized a briefing by the U.S. delegation of U.S. NGOs for 6 p.m., and there were more than 200 U.S. people waiting for the delegation at UNISA, which is the university building nearby to the official conference center. The delegation arrived and spoke to several of us who were representatives of the U.S. NGO Coordinating Committee and insisted that they would only walk into the room to do a briefing if all the media that was in the room left. They said that they had decided to withdraw, that that was the only statement that they could make, that they could not take any questions, but that they would not make the statement in front of the NGOs with media present. By that point, even prior to that arrival, the mood in the amongst the UN NGOs was very organized, very united. A lot of slogan chanting had already gone on with people talking about slavery as a crime against humanity, the demand for reparations, discussions about the whole Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So I think part of the U.S. delegation's hesitance to address the NGOs also came, I think, from a sense of discomfort and fear of having to deal with this very organized and militant crowd. What ended up happening was that they ended up leaving. They did not officially address the U.S. NGOs who were assembled. They spoke to some of us and said that exactly what they had said to the Indigenous Caucus prior to the meeting, that they could not take any questions until the official White House statement had been issued. At that point, the 200-strong, more than 200-strong group went into an organizing mode. We began a conversation about what we were going to do, how we were going to unite, and how we were going to take a stand against the U.S. abandoning this very important conference. That dialogue turned into a spontaneous march to the International Conference Center, where we were barred, as you had mentioned earlier. But what was really amazing and wonderful was the kind of energy and synergy that everyone demonstrated, where quickly all of our issues became all of our issues. You know, we were talking about reparations, about indigenous rights, about immigrant rights, about trafficking in women, the problems being faced by people of Asian descent. And it really became a reflection of the true diversity of our communities across the United States. This morning, the demonstrations continued at 9 o'clock in the morning, again outside the ICC. And if anything, it was even more colorful, more vibrant, more heterogeneous than the night before, where we were also joined by members of groups from all over the world who stood in solidarity with us to call accountability to the U.S. government. Tons of media were present, including, you know, CNN, ABC, all of these different folks. And I think what we are trying to say is that, yes, the U.S. government is not here. Yes, the U.S. government is not being accountable. But we, the U.S. community, in all of our diversity and strength, are here. And we are going to continue the demand for racial justice going forward.
Can I ask both of you what your reaction is to the reasons that were given ultimately, particularly here in the United States, the U.S. and Israel pulling out of the conference? The Washington Post puts it, charging the meeting had been hijacked by Arab nations and converted into a forum for extremist diatribes against Israel and Jews. The New York Times quotes Powell, "I have taken this decision with regret because of the importance of the international fight against racism and the contribution the conference could have made to it. But following discussions, our team in Durban and others who are working for a successful conference, I'm convinced that will not be possible." Saying the proposed documents assail the racist practices of Zionism and describe Israel's treatment of Palestinians as a new kind of apartheid. Tom Goldtooth, your response to that.
I had specifically asked the two delegates of the United States Department yesterday on what their reasons were and whether or not it was specifically related to the potential announcement of Israel to pull out their delegates. The delegates, made a strong point that they would not discuss that. There was a sense from our indigenous caucus that met with them that there was a correlation to, you know, a lot of the protests, that the passion, the concerns of genocide, ethnocide, of war crimes of the Palestinian peoples, and the desire for some kind of action to be taken from this body here that's convening. And I was thinking about this whole thing is that there seemed to be a pattern of the United States government in these type of hard issues that they seem to be impatient. And I was surprised. In fact, I was very frustrated that our delegation from the United States did not want to continue on to address these issues of racial discrimination, and because these are not easy issues. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. And I feel that they have a serious responsibility, not only to themselves, but also to the people here. We traveled here, we raised monies. Some people, you know, had cakewalks just to get monies to be here, and only to see our delegation come late and leave early. And you know, we have a long history as American Indian and Alaska Native peoples with treaty making, government-to-government relationship, in dealings with representatives of the United States government. We have government-to-government responsibilities to each other that's been reserved through legal instruments as indigenous peoples in the United States. And this is just a continuation of the attitudes and the policies and practices that the United States has perpetuated against indigenous peoples. When issues get really tough and hard, they pull back. If they don't get their way, they pout, just like little children. Unfortunately, you know, we have the public, the civil society, the NGOs of the United States, so we're here to witness this. It's something that, you know, one of us, we made a remark that, you know, there's empty seats there now. Empty seats. Who is representing the United States in this very important conference? And some of us were saying, maybe we as American Indian Alaska Native, since we are the first Americans, since we are the First Nations and the Aboriginals of United States, maybe we should go and sit in those seats, because who has more of a right to talk about these issues and are impacted as well in discrimination? Is us as Native people to come over there and sit down in those seats and bring our brothers and sisters from African American and Mexican American, Asian American, who are also being disenfranchised from ineffective federal laws that fail to protect, you know, our people of color back home and our Native peoples.
Tom Goldtooth, you had been trying, the Indigenous Environmental Network, trying to arrange a meeting for days with the U.S. delegation. What did you want to raise?
That's right. You know, there's many issues, but, you know, in order to cut to some of the very serious issues that we've been addressing here is in this draft declaration that all the countries are considering, there's a couple articles that are written in the draft that's been just a slap in the face against indigenous peoples worldwide concerning self-determination and the rights of indigenous peoples. There's a caveat paragraph that is paragraph 27 of this official World Conference State Declaration, and it's a manifestation of racism against indigenous peoples and constitutes a racist attack by the United Nations on the rights of indigenous peoples. We are demanding that paragraph be deleted in its entirety. Furthermore, any qualifications on the right of indigenous peoples to self-determination is racist and is contrary to the fundamental principles of international law. Basically, that term, it brings out the term indigenous peoples with the S word. And the United Nations and the states. And I need to say that this whole effort in the PrepCom 3 in Geneva at the end of July and 1st of August was led by the United States government. And what it did, it made reference to the term of indigenous people being in the context of ongoing multilateral agreements on texts that specifically deal with such rights and is without prejudice to the outcome of those negotiations. Basically, it tells us as indigenous peoples that your rights are again put on hold until future negotiations are being worked out within the United Nations framework. I mean, that's outright racist. And that takes away our status and fundamental human rights that are inherent in all peoples. And for some reason, here at this conference, in this draft declaration, it just does not adhere to us. Okay? So we're not being recognized. We're not being respected. We're not being, our status as peoples is not being adhered to.
Finally, Malik Adut, this latest information of the UN Human Rights Commissioner, Mary Robinson, saying that she got a call from the head of the U.S. delegation at the airport saying the U.S. would keep a single official in Durban who would retain delegate status, and that means that the U.S. wasn't entirely withdrawing. What is that about?
I think it's about political immaturity. Once again, I think that this administration has shown over and over again that most of the time it doesn't really know what it's doing. And in the process, because it is a superpower, it's floundering on foreign policy issues, just ends up making it and its policies look stupid. Right now, the information that we have is that there's one of two individuals, John Blaney, who is the charge d'affaires at the U.S. Consulate in Pretoria, or Craig Huell, who is the consul general for the U.S. Embassy in Durban. It's one of these two people who will assume this so-called delegate status, and they're going to have the ability to get this, phone in amendments to the document. So they're not even going to have to be physically present to be accountable to all of us who are out here or to respond to any questions. They're going to be able to phone in and participate in the document drafting process by telephone. You know, this statement was just made a little while ago, so we haven't had a chance to follow up either with Mary Robinson's office or with anybody from the U.S. delegation as to what the hell they're talking about or what they really mean by this. I personally think that the U.N. should not allow the U.S. to participate in this fashion. I think that the United Nations, instead of kowtowing once again to this kind of being pushed around, should just put its foot down and say, you know, you're either here like the rest of us or you're not here. It puts all of us as U.S. NGOs in a very peculiar position because on the one hand, the U.S. is withdrawn, and on the other hand, there's this sort of one person here who's not going to be accountable to anybody.
And would it mean the U.S. would sign on to the final document?
Well, I think what they're doing is basically reserving the right to do whatever they want. And so we have no idea what this implies as far as their token representation or their final signing on to the document means. We're hopefully going to have more information in a couple of hours, and we'll try and fill you in tomorrow. But like I said, we just found this out less than an hour ago, so we're still trying to sort out the details. But what I just want to add over here is that I think that what this whole process has shown us over and over again is that human rights issues are just as relevant in the United States as they are globally. And that as U.S. NGOs and as our government behaves, we really have to be responsible and take and hold them accountable for U.S. human rights violations domestically and globally. And their immaturity around the international process makes it even more important for us as U.S. NGOs to understand our role in a globalized international human rights context.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. We've been speaking with Malika Dutt, who is a member of the U.S. NGO Coordinating Committee for the World Conference Against Racism, and Tom Goldtooth, Executive Director of the Indigenous Environmental Network at the conference on behalf of the International Indian Treaty Council, originally from Bemidji and the headwaters of the Mississippi in northern Minnesota. And you are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back from our break, we'll hear the voices of protest as the U.S. pulled out last night on the streets of Durban, South Africa. We're live at the World Conference. Stay with us.